Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens. What does it take to get a raise, a promotion, or a new job? If you're a woman, the answer to those questions are different than they are for men. So says our guest, Sally Helgeson, who has been called the world's premier expert on women's leadership. Sally is the author of several books, the latest of which is called How Women Rise, Break the 12 Habits Holding You Back from Your Next Raise, Promotion, or Job.
Sally, thank you so much for joining us.
It is a pleasure to be here with both of you.
We'd love to know how the book came about, because I know you've written several other ones, but how did this one come to be?
Yes, this is my seventh book in the fields of either women's leadership or leadership in general. And I love the way this one came about. I have been for the last, I would say, 7 or 8 years delivering workshops all around the world to women leaders and aspiring leaders on developing a more intentional approach to their career development. And as I was doing that, I began using my co-author on this book, Marshall Goldsmith's classic million seller, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. A really terrific book about the behaviors that get in the way of successful people. I found the book very useful because Marshall makes the point that the same behaviors that often help people on the way up can become problematic for them as they seek to rise higher in the organization. That is a perfect example of something nobody ever tells you.
Yeah.
So, that's great. I was using that book, and the overriding idea was great, but as I used it, I noticed that many of the behaviors that he focused on, some were gender neutral, but many of them were very specifically male behaviors, and some of the behaviors that I had seen in 30 years of working with women leaders around the world were not included in that book. For example, Marshall talks about a behavior he sees getting in the way of many of the male leaders he works with, being a refusal or discomfort with apologizing. And as you both know, and as I've seen for years, women have no problem apologizing. And in fact, sometimes say, I'm sorry just for opening the door and coming in the room.
Yeah, tripping over themselves apologizing. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, another behavior he has in there is talking constantly about how great you are. It's not a problem that most women have. So I went to Marshall, whom I've known for almost 25 years, and said, you know, we really should collaborate on a book that takes this approach. You know, what got you here won't necessarily get you there, and it's something nobody ever told you, but look specifically at the behaviors that get in the way of successful women. Not in order to blame women for not having risen higher, but in order to help them by taking actions that lie within their control.
Before we get into these 12 behaviors, I just want to know, what do most women think the definition of success is?
Ah, that's a really, really great question. It's fascinating. My work has indicated that women often tend to define success a little bit differently than men. They often take satisfaction in leading teams, in exercising their greatest talents, in gaining recognition for what they do, but they tend to take less satisfaction in purely, in terms of achieving a high-ranking position or in terms of what their salary is. Now, I am not saying that women's salary, women's financial prospects are not profoundly important to them, nor that women don't aspire to higher positions. But if they find that when they're in a higher position and earning a lot of money, that the job, the actual quality of their life in the job is profoundly dissatisfying, not just on a temporary basis, but over time, they are less likely to be engaged and will often describe the job as not worth it. So women define success a little bit differently, and I would say that the primary difference, and research bears this out, is that women like to feel that they have some control over their time, the ability to build the time to build relationships that really matter to them, and that they feel that the work that they're doing makes a real positive difference. That those things are very important to women, and that they're up there with salary and with position. So it's a kind of broader spectrum. So in this book, what we say is we're aiming it at successful women, but the women get to define what success means to them, what they feel would make their career a success.
And how did you determine the 12 habits that hold women back in the workplace?
Well, I would say that the majority of those habits came from the work I've done with women, as I said, for the last 30 years, since my earlier book, The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, was published. That was almost 30 years ago. And so I've been doing workshops with women, half day or full day workshops over that period of time. And I've had a fantastic opportunity to witness behaviors in conversations that have gotten in women's ways. I've also moderated probably thousands of panels with successful women and heard them talk about what helped them and what got in their way. So most of the behaviors, I would say probably 9, came directly from my experience, and probably another 3 came from Marshall's coaching practice. Marshall's ranked as the world's number one executive coach and has been for the last 8 years.
Wow.
And his coaching practice, I know, wow. His coaching practice has been mostly, you know, because he coaches CEOs, it's been about 75% to 80% men, but he certainly has experience coaching successful women. So he was also able to weigh in on that. And one of the things Marshall said to me early on when we were working on the book that made a real impact was he said, you know, whenever I am coaching a woman, no matter how high up she is or how successful she's been, how many accolades she has, how much money she earns, how famous she is, he said, I almost always have to say the same thing. Don't give yourself such a hard time. He said, because in his view, in his experience, women are so much more self-critical than men are. And a number of the behaviors that we have in the book, such as seeking perfection or minimizing or being reluctant to claim your achievements, I think really reflect that characteristic of women. Being modest, being appropriate, trying to give other people credit and shine a light on other people's achievements, all of those are wonderful things. But holding on to and ruminating over mistakes that you may have made is not productive.
I have a two-part question here. Which one of these habits do you think holds back most women, and which held you back professionally the most?
Aha. Well, okay. I would say that the number ones in the experience I have, I should say the ones, I did a couple workshops. The book just came out on April 10th, but I was doing a couple preliminary workshops. And by far, the behaviors, when I said, you know, how many of you feel this behavior applies to you? The ones that got the most hands in the air were attempting to be perfect, the perfection trap, the disease to please, feeling that you have to be a wonderful person to everyone, and also overvaluing expertise. That's a big one. Focusing all your attention on mastering the details of your job, doing a great job, but not at the same time building the kind of relationships and visibility that will get you rewarded for the job that you're doing. You have to do all of those at one time. Now, the other one that gets a lot is expecting other people to, this is my favorite of all the behaviors, expecting other people to spontaneously notice and reward your contributions rather than having to some degree advertise those yourself. So often women feel that, you know, when I say, are you good at drawing notice to what you've achieved? The women who say that they're not, and that's usually the preponderance in the programs I deliver, will say, I'll say, why aren't you good? And I'll hear one of two responses. The first is, if I have to act like that jerk down the hall to get noticed, no thank you, which betrays a kind of either or mindset. You know, either you're constantly talking about yourself and sucking up all the air, or you're just hanging back hoping to be noticed. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I hear is, I feel that if I do great work, people should notice. And maybe in a perfect world, they should. But people are really busy. And unless you're able to find a way that's comfortable for you to bring notice to what you do, then I would say you're not going to be able to draw the attention you need to draw in order to be visible. As far as I go myself, I would say that has been a problematic behavior for me, expecting others to notice and reward what I achieve. And the other really has also been seeking perfection, that fear of mistakes, going over and over and over everything I do, probably investing a little bit too much effort in it. I began to notice I do a lot of programs, as I've alluded to, and I began to notice that, you know, I was putting so much work into them that by the time I delivered them, I was kind of stressed out and almost looking for it to be over. So I have had to force myself to do a little bit less perfectionistic preparation and, you know, trust the process, trust the questions I ask, and trust the groups that I work with to respond.
So that leads to another question then. How would you suggest someone examine themselves to see if they have any of these habits that are holding them back from their next raise or promotion or job?
Well, my first suggestion, of course, would be to go into their favorite bookstore or onto any online bookseller and order How Women Rise. And then once they've done that, I would ask them to read the book and think through what ones of those behaviors do they feel may be holding them back. And again, it's important to recognize that these very behaviors may have been helpful to you as a woman earlier in your career and may in fact have been instrumental in helping you to get where you are. But as you think intentionally through what does success look like for me? Where do I want to rise to in terms of my position? What would be the most satisfying use of my talents in this world? And what is the path to get there? As you ask yourself that question, think about, you know, what ones of these behaviors might get in your way. Because we provide really vivid examples in the book, I haven't found anybody who said I can't identify with some of these behaviors. In fact, often the problem is people email me or are in touch with me on LinkedIn and say, help, I identify with 10 of these behaviors. Where do I start? So knowing where to start is key.
Why is it that millennial women seem to be held back by the same beliefs that women in my mother's generation were held back by?
Isn't that interesting? I know it. I think that there is you know, particularly around this word and around this concept of ambition, there's a lot of ambivalence. Ambition has been often viewed as almost a dirty word for women. Oh, she's so ambitious. You know, she's really eager to, you know, to rise in this organization. People will say that critically. And I think that that general, you know, cultural bias, is still exists in organizations. I will say that I don't think that it exists to the extent that it did in most organizations, certainly in good organizations, when I started my journey in women's, working with women leaders and writing about women's leadership 30 years ago. It is much better than it was, but there still is a sort of skepticism, and often from women themselves, about ambitious women. And I think that holds women back and makes them feel as if they have to justify, you know, justify what they're doing. I interviewed in this book a woman who's a psychiatrist on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, New York City. And she works with some of the most successful women in financial services and in big law firms. And she said something amazing. She said, the majority of the women come into my office and the first thing they tell me is, I'm not really ambitious. And she said she's floored, because if you're not ambitious, how did you manage to make partner at one of the top 10 law firms on the planet? That doesn't really add up. And what the woman is really saying is, I'm a nice person. I'm a helpful person. I'm not someone who eats nails for breakfast and steps over my colleagues. But that may be true, but we don't need to either to conceive of ambition and women as being that kind of behavior. We can be ambitious for achieving our own goals. We can claim that. And I think the more we're willing to do that, the easier it will become for younger women, millennials, and the generation following them to be able to do that.
You know, one of the habits that you say can hold women back in the workplace is building rather than leveraging relationships. Tell us more about that.
Well, that is something I've become, you know, really aware of over the years. In The Female Advantage, which, as I said, was the first book that I wrote in this series and was published in 1990, very proud to say it was the first book to focus on what women had to contribute rather than how they needed to change and adapt. And what I focused in that book on describing the leadership style of some of America's best women leaders. And what stuck out to me immediately when I began studying those leaders was how good they were at building relationships, at creating strong relationships, not only with other people, but making sure that the people in their organizations also had strong and good and rich and rewarding relationships. And I think one of the things that we see when we look at research that leaders say that women are best at is building and maintaining relationships. So I began to think a number of years ago, well, if women are so great at building relationships, and if the skill of building relationships is becoming ever more valued at a leadership level, which I believe it is, it was not necessarily in the 1980s seen as something that was part of a profile of a leader. If women are great at it and it's so valued, how come that's not helping more women rise to positions of power? And one thing I began to recognize as I dug down deeply with my workshop participants was that while women were building networks, while they were building relationships with people broadly, they often hung back when it came to using those relationships in any way strategically or with reciprocity, to try to use those relationships to achieve a goal at work, to achieve an ambition, to get to the next level in their work, or even just to get a task done. They would often hang back at using these very robust and well-developed networks because they'd say things like, I'd say, you know, are you good at this? And they'd say, no, I'm not, but I want so-and-so to know that I really value her as a friend, that I'm not using her. So I think that women often feel that engaging the people in their network, engaging people with whom they have a relationship to try to achieve an objective is somehow very transactional and indicates that you don't necessarily really like that person and are open to using that person. So instead of seeing things in those kind of black and white terms, I think it's really good to think about, you know, how can I use these relationships reciprocally? How can I ask people to help me, but also offer myself as a resource to help them? Because that's really how leveraging relationships works. It's a very reciprocal kind of process. And sometimes I think the reason women struggle with it is because they don't necessarily see themselves as a great resource for people who know them. They don't, you know, they're not looking at themselves. Once you see yourself as a player, as someone who other people could really benefit by knowing, it's much easier to enlist help because you know that person recognizes that you can be helpful to them also in the future.
I love that. I haven't heard anything like that, and I think that makes so much sense. And going along with that, I know a lot of women are tougher on other women because they view them as competition. And there's just something about, I don't know, cattiness and girl fights that are kind of different than a man's relationship with a woman. But how important is it for women to support other women? And how can we do that even though sometimes it goes against our nature?
I think it's one of the most important things. And I want to say this. I have, you know, again, I've been doing this 30 years, and I have witnessed over the years remarkable and repeated examples of women helping other women. I do think women sometimes get a bad rap for not helping other women, because guess what? Men never walk into a room and say, hey, how can I help the men here? It's not something men are necessarily expected to do, is to help one another. They help one another in the kind of reciprocal way where they say, you know, you help me on this and I'll help you there. But they're not necessarily thinking in terms of how can I help other men. So I do think women to some degree get a bad rap on it. But also I think that some of the behaviors such as gossiping or criticizing are more common among women when they're young. You see that kind of, you know, catfight behavior, that sort of masked aggression, if you will, that among young girls and particularly among teenage girls, and it's often accepted. And so women can, in those cases, fall rather naturally into being critical of other women. It's always a mistake, especially in our social media environment. You never want to say anything. You never want to say anything negative about anybody, and you certainly don't want to say it in any venue that could become public, because it stirs up trouble and it can be a bullying behavior. I think we tend often to think of bullying as something, a one-way street with men to women, but women also, we need to admit, when women are nasty to one another, it is a bullying behavior. So I think we need to be a little more honest about what some of those impacts can be, and we need to hold one another to account. I know that for myself, often people will come to me and say, oh, did you see what she did? That was just ridiculous. And I always say, you know, why are you coming to me with that? If you really feel that the person that you're upset with did something that you object to, why don't you go to her? I don't want to talk with you about it.
Right.
And it kind of brings people up short. So I think it's really important to stop any kind of gossip train in its tracks when people try to enlist you. Often it's a way of people trying to make themselves feel better, but it's also a sign of powerlessness. And one of the things that struck me right from the get-go when I started doing research onto women's leadership is learning that the more women who were in positions of influence and authority in organizations, the more women tended to support one another. It's when you have situations where there are very few women who are in positions of influence and power, very few of them, that scarcity mentality kicks off and women tend to snipe and undermine each other. So really the solution to women undermining one another is more women in positions of influence and authority who don't tolerate that and who set a positive tone and show women what they can aspire to.
What other words to the wise would you have to women with regard to their social media activity holding them back in terms of the workplace?
Well, that's really interesting. And, you know, being on a book tour right now, I'm struggling with it in a way that I never have. I hear the most frequent, I don't want to call it a criticism or complaint, I'll call it an observation, that I hear from women in positions of authority and influence about a younger generation of women is that they have a difficult time being present because they're so accustomed to interacting on technology. And I think that in today's very technology-rich environment, every one of us, I call it, has to become almost their own HR department. That is, they have to think about, you know, what are my policies, what are my practices around how I communicate? Because for every one of us, it's really important that we maintain enough calmness and enough centeredness that we can really authentically communicate with other people who are before us instead of being distracted by constantly, I mean, I'm in airports all the time. People are on elevators and escalators and getting in the train and they're all staring at their phone. They're all communicating that way and they're not even really looking up. And, you know, your brain gets used to the way you act and then it becomes more and more difficult not to act. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen some of those studies that show that that some, you know, people in their early 20s are actually having difficulty recognizing people's facial expressions because they've become so they're so unused to interacting with people one-on-one. So I think that, you know, it's not strictly a social media question. It's more a technology question, but social media is often the culprit there. And one of the behaviors in the book we have, it, you know, really has to do with minimizing your presence. And that is using words and body language in a way that doesn't take up space. And think about it. When you are constantly interacting with your technology, say on social media, and other people are actively present, you're not taking up any of the real space in the world. You're only taking up virtual space. And that just weakens your ability to be present for people and to exert and to have a leadership presence. I think there's a real reason that the word presence and present are the same word. If we're not present for the people we're with, then we don't really have a presence. We don't have a leadership presence. And that's going to weaken us as we seek to rise.
Sally, we've got one final question for you. Our program is called Nobody Told Me, and we always like to ask our guests, what is your Nobody Told Me lesson? So in your case, you are called the premier expert on women's leadership. What lesson do you wish you had learned along the way, learned at the beginning, that would have saved you a lot of headache and heartache?
I think the lesson that I wish I would have learned was to have more confidence when using my voice, when speaking up. I came at this, you know, I became, Forbes said that, you know, the world's premier women's leadership expert. That's pretty humbling.
Amazing.
But I, you know, that has happened because I've been able to use my voice as a speaker, and I've been able to become comfortable inhabiting the role of an expert. When I first started in this field, I came at it as a writer. A lot of my colleagues came at it as behavioral psychologists or organizational psychologists. And I felt like I was hiding behind my writing, and that's where my expertise lay. So becoming comfortable inhabiting the role of being an expert has been part of my real journey to becoming one.
And the other quick question, how can people find out more about you and your work and your website?
They can visit me at sallyhelgeson.com or go to the How Women Rise website that my publisher has put up. If you visit me at sallyhelgeson.com, there's a contact button, and you can also connect with me or my co-author, Marshall Goldsmith, on LinkedIn. We're very active on LinkedIn.
All right. Well, Sally, thank you so much for joining us. This has been very enlightening.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Sally Helgeson has been our guest. Again, her book, co-authored with Marshall Goldsmith, is called How Women Rise, Break the 12 Habits Holding You Back from Your Next Raise, Promotion, or Job. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You've been listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you for joining us.